Welcome to Newsworthy with Norrisworthy. Get ready for some awesome.
Well, welcome to Newsworthy with Norrisworthy. Today is a special edition of Newsworthy with Norrisworthy because we are getting sporty. So if you're not a fan of hearing a little bit about sports, then this might not be the episode for you, but don't worry. We've got some great programming in store for you at the beginning of 2014. But today, we're talking about the most recent 30 for 30 documentary that ESPN aired this last weekend, entitled Youngstown Boys. As soon as I saw this, I thought this needs to be a podcast, so I sent the bat signal out for someone who knows something about sports, because I needed an expert on this show. And before the bat sign could even reach outer space, we got a response from CBS Sports' own Mr. Grant Boone. So Grant, welcome to the show.
Hello, Luke.
Hey, thanks for joining us today, Grant. How's life in Abilene?
As just aesthetically gorgeous as always.
Now, you told me that you were not feeling so good today, and I wonder if that's really a little bit of nerves, because I wonder if you're maybe a little bit more nervous about being on the Newsworthy with Norrisworthy show than you were, say, when you were calling Amen Corner this last year at the Masters.
This is like when hitters would see that Randy Johnson was pitching.
Yes.
And they're like, I want no part of it. I suddenly have an immediate case of the bubonic plague or whatever the disease du jour might happen to be. Yeah, that's you're on to me.
Well, I want you to relax. I want you to know this is going to be fun for everyone involved, including you.
Okay. I'll take your word for it.
Now, do we need to say up front that as we're talking about this documentary that was produced by the ABC network or family of networks, that you're obviously going to hate it because you work for CBS Sports?
No, I hold out a cardboard sign that says we'll broadcast for food. I mean, I've worked for ESPN, Longhorn Network. It's, you know, if have microphone, will travel.
Yeah. So you're just going to do whatever pays you the bills, right?
Without question. I mean, hey, my allegiance goes as far as my bank account.
Hey, just cut the check, baby. That's what we're all about here at Newsworthy with Norrisworthy.
And let's talk about, we might want to settle that up front. Are you going to pay in Bitcoin or what?
Well, this is actually the barter system. That's how we pay.
Okay.
And so I will give you a hug afterwards. That is the barter system I work with.
A cyber hug, preferably. You don't want what I have, trust me.
Yeah. Now, I just got to admit, even though you're sick, you probably have the best voice that's ever been on Newsworthy with Norrisworthy.
That's probably true, but I've seen the other people and heard the other people you've had on, so that's not saying much.
No.
I mean, we're talking Jonathan Stormett, whose voice still hasn't changed.
Yeah. We're hoping it's going to do that soon, though. Yeah. We really are. Now, what is the actual title for what you do?
I'm a play-by-play guy, sports broadcaster, sports commentator, sports caster, all of those. And you need to address me as all of those each time you refer to me.
I'll think about that towards the end of the show.
Okay, sportscaster's fine.
Okay, now as a sportscaster, why do people in your profession always have to find some backstory? It's like, you know, someone catches a touchdown pass and you go, well, this is the first game their mother has seen since she got her nose done. Why are you guys so obsessed with giving us a backstory behind the game?
Well, I think it's because it makes it more interesting. You know, generally speaking, you're going to have a group that's going to watch the game no matter what. You might remember hearing you were just a mere twinkle in your parents' eyes, I'm sure. But back in the early 80s, there was a broadcast of the Jets and Dolphins on NBC that had no announcers, just graphics. And that was the great Don Ohlmeyer, a longtime television producer, still in the business, with whom I've had the chance to work, and in fact, with his son as well at ESPN. I'm done name dropping for the moment. but there were no announcers, and a lot of people liked it. So you've got the hardcore group that is going to watch no matter what. But then you also have the fringe group that gets sucked in, and you have have others who are just maybe casual fans. And the general idea is you don't want to just say, you know, so and so scored. You want to put some context to it. Now, I think you can go overboard. Mm-hmm. And I think some sports lend themselves more to it than others. Some media lend themselves to it more than others. For example, when you're broadcasting the Olympics, especially, you know, when you think about a sport like gymnastics or figure skating. You know, it's not nonstop action. And so you have a little bit more time. And especially when you think about overseas Olympics, where you're not seeing it live, you have a, you know, you have a chance to set it up and explain why, you know, how these people got there, why they are important, you know, what's at stake. When I'm calling a basketball game like I will tonight up in Lubbock, you know, I'm going to be broadcasting on the radio. I barely have time to say who's made the basket before the other team is back down court and already running another play. You don't have time for context when you're doing play-by-play of basketball. But, you know, when you're watching on television, I as a sportscaster don't have to say, Peyton Manning drops back. He looks over the defense. He looks to his right. He pump fake. I don't have to say that because you can see it. But in radio, I do have to be the eyes and ears of the audience because they can't see it. So it depends on the media, the specific way you're transmitting the broadcast. So for me, I think more people want to at least have an idea as to who these people are, why they should be watching. You're always going to have the core element they're going to watch no matter what. But generally, I just think it makes it more interesting.
Yeah. Well, that seems to be what the 30 for 30 series is doing. They're giving you a full backstory of what's going on with these athletes. A lot of times, these are stories that are that have been over for 5, 10, 20, 30 years. Yeah. But they're still giving you the story. And you've probably seen a lot of these, haven't you, the 30 for 30?
Oh, I've seen almost all of them. Yeah, they're terrific. The idea really came from Bill Simmons, the sports guy. Mm-hmm. He doesn't even call himself the sports guy anymore, but you know he's been a dozen years at ESPN as you know, and he's risen now to cult stardom. He's one of their key contributors on TV, on podcasts, online. And Bill Simmons had the idea, hey, why don't we to celebrate ESPN's 30th anniversary in 2009? Why don't we come up with documentaries that will look at the biggest stories that have happened since ESPN went on? Mm-hmm. And so that's why you see all of these things that have happened since 1979.
Okay, that makes sense.
Yeah, and so the idea, you know, was so popular and it was so well received that they've done a second edition, a second volume of these documentaries. And the one about Youngstown Boys you know, documents the story of two guys from Youngstown, Jim Tressel, who became the head coach at Youngstown State and then went on to coach Ohio State before resigning, and Maurice Claret, a great running back for Ohio State, who came from Youngstown, led them to a national championship and then was subsequently kicked off the team for reasons that the documentary showed differ depending on who you are.
Yeah. So the story is his car is broken into on campus. He files
not his car.
I know, but the car he's driving.
Car he was driving. That's where you get into the sticky part.
And supposedly his car was in the shop, and someone, was it Tressel's brother maybe, who sent him to a dealer that would give him a rental or what? Somehow there's some weird agreement there, and that tears the whole thing apart. Like that's
the yeah. Print. His car doesn't work, and so he calls his coach, who is something of a father figure to him. His own father abandoned the family, and so he's not just Jim Tressel's not just Claret's coach. He's his mentor, his you know, surrogate father in a way. He says, "Hey, my car's broken down." Tressel says, "Go to this car dealer. They'll set you up. They'll get you a vehicle while yours, you know, is being repaired." So he's in that new Monte Carlo at the gym. It gets broken into. They file a police report. And then, you know, from there, that gets sucked into a larger NCAA investigation. And there was a story before that even happened, though, that led to some discord between Claret and the athletic director at Ohio State, Andy Geiger. At the national championship game, they were already there in Tempe, Arizona for the game, and Claret's a best friend from, you know, his childhood days. His good friend was killed in a drug-related murder. He wanted to go back. There were NCAA funds, and there are, for situations like that. We're going to get the guy back for the funeral. Then he can fly back to Tempe for the game. Geiger, for whatever reason, opted not to push that through. He said it was for a variety of reasons. Paperwork wasn't filled out. And so Claret did not go back for the funeral of his close, close friend from his childhood days in Youngstown, Ohio. And therefore, Claret essentially called out the Ohio State Athletics Department and said, you know, that they were the reason why he didn't go back. And he was frustrated. He expressed his frustration. And then you go back even further a couple of months to a story that was done by Gene Wojciechowski, a terrific writer for ESPN. And he had done a big, full-blown story on ESPN, the magazine, on Maurice Claret, during which time Claret said in the interview, hey, I might want to explore the possibility of challenging the NCAA's rule prohibiting me from entering the NFL before I've been out of high school for 3 years. I'm considering doing that. I might be interested in pursuing that. I'm a running back. Historically, running backs do not have a long career because of the beating they take. Anyway, that story didn't set well with Ohio State fans, certainly not the administration of the athletics department. And then you couple the fact that he basically called out Ohio State for not making sure he got back for his friend's funeral. You know, meanwhile, by the way, he scores 2 touchdowns to lead Ohio State to the national championship win over Miami. But the administration clearly is frustrated with him. And I keep saying administration, I mean the athletics administration.
Yeah.
And they opt, when this trouble comes, really to stand by and not back Maurice Claret like I think they would have had there not been that discord. That's my opinion. Now, really? You know, of course, Andy Geiger was not very well represented in this documentary, the former Ohio State, athletics director. He's now moved on. He's an AD somewhere else now. Mm-hmm. I think Milwaukee, Wisconsin is where he is now.
Yes.
But, as it turns out, it really you start looking at all of the things that happened. The end result was that Claret was suspended from the team for the entire 2003 season, that entire following season. He never again played for Ohio State. He tried to enter the NFL draft after sitting out the next year after that. He was drafted by the Broncos. He didn't make the team. He fell into some really bad habits, drinking prescription drugs, getting in with the wrong crowd. And by the time he got to the Broncos training camp, he was a mess. He was addicted to alcohol. Mm-hmm. According to the documentary, he was even, you know, sipping alcohol during practice, which is crazy.
I believe he called that getting his goose on.
Is that what they call it?
Yeah, well, drinking his gray goose during practice.
Yeah, well, yeah, I'm not hip like you are, so I wouldn't know that. So it ruffled the feathers of the Broncos, let's put it that way, and they wound up cutting him. And so he never even took a snap in the NFL, even in the preseason. And thankfully, as we fast forward, you know, he seems to have gotten his life together after being arrested and in jail for, 3 years.
Yep.
He got his life together and he's running a youth football operation where he teaches kids the game of football, speaks to correctional facilities all over Ohio about how people can get out and find a way, even though they're in that current situation. So the end result was really strong and positive. He really has righted his ship, but it really brings up a lot of questions about how Ohio State treated this young man who came from really dirt poor upbringing in Youngstown, Ohio. And it's all part of a larger examination right now that the NCAA is under. I mean, the NCAA is on a petri dish right now, and everything is being every part of the NCAA is under a microscope. A lot of their tactics and practices are being challenged. There's a humongous lawsuit right now going on that's challenging the NCAA's relationship with video games, using the likenesses of college athletes in basketball and football, and yet not passing any of that on to the actual athletes. I'm telling you, we could be heading for NCAA Armageddon here before too very long, because they've operated in a very broad way without a lot of checks and balances. They've had a lot of protection from the courts. I'm not sure that's going to last a lot longer. And I thought this documentary was timely in that regard.
Well, yeah, the documentary definitely makes the NCAA and Andy Geiger look like the villain in the story.
Yeah.
And it does, on first glance, it definitely seems like that's obviously the bad guy in the story. But if you look at what's happened after the Claret incident, okay, Claret ends up in jail, armed robbery, then gun charges. Tressel has his third big scandal that ends up with him losing his job and having this 5-year ban from college football.
Yeah.
And you go, who really is the villain? Okay, who's really the villain in this story? It looks like it's Andy Geiger and the NCAA, but in some ways, it seems like they're whitewashing the whole Claret Tressel side of it.
Well, as I watched the story unfold, it seemed to me, and I have no insider information here, but it seems to me that Tressel covered his own backside. Mm-hmm. Because when everything was going down in that summer, when Claret was first busted for that the NCAA issue with the car, Tressel had a chance to step in and say, this is a good guy. He comes from nothing, and he's done nothing wrong here. It doesn't appear, maybe something happened that I don't know about. It doesn't appear that really the lion's share of the blame in this case should go to Claret in that initial instance.
Yep.
Now, he's certainly guilty of some stuff since then. But it seems to me that everything he did was on the advice of Jim Tressel. And then when he got busted, Jim Tressel really didn't stand behind him and stand up for him. And as I listened to Jim Tressel try to explain what happened in those early days after the whole thing blew up, and then in the months following, as Claret was not welcomed back to the team, he sure seemed to have the sound of a guy who was not standing up for the guy that, he had promised to stand up for. He had promised Claret's mother, I can't promise you how much you'll play, can't promise you how many wins we'll have, but I can promise you we'll treat him like one of our family. Well, here's a guy who needs his coach to stand up for him. And it sure looked like that Tressel didn't fight for Maurice Claret. He instead kowtowed to the athletics department and kept his job while Claret was kind of kicked to the curb. So the sense I got was that Tressel caved in and then felt really embarrassed and bad about it later. He and Claret have mended their ways. And guess what? There are situations that we find ourselves in like that.
Yeah.
You've got a very high profile, high paying job, and you've got a young man who will very conveniently be branded as the bad guy, mm-hmm. allow you to keep going. I've actually had some situations like this in my broadcasting career where I had, some people right above me who said some things to management, and they weren't necessarily true. And when it came time to fight for me, they didn't. And that was their choice. And it was hurtful. Mm. At the end of the day, you move on and you have to forgive. And it seems like that's what Maurice Claret has done. I mean, the documentary ended with him and Tressel. Tressel, of course, as you pointed out a second ago, he's become persona non grata now. at Ohio State after yet another scandal. He resigned in disgrace. Mm-hmm. He's, you know, if anyone wants to hire Jim Tressel as their head coach in the NCAA these days, they would have to be subject to NCAA sanctions. He is what they call a show cause case. You have to show, if you're a school that wants to hire him, you have to show good cause as to why you're going to hire him. That doesn't expire until the end of December of 2016. So he's got three more years that he has to sit out. It sure looked to me, I don't know about you, mm-hmm. that Tressel didn't stand up for him, knew he wasn't standing up for him, tried to give some weak sauce explanation as to why he wasn't.
Yeah.
And then, you know, felt terrible about it and obviously has amended, you know, has made up with Clarette since then. And Clarette forgave him, which was huge on Clarette, I thought.
Yeah. You know, you look at Clarette, and obviously he made some mistakes, but he was the one who was a kid in the story. I mean, he's 19 years old, 18, yeah. 19. He goes to college before his senior year of high school is even over. He's right. there really as a young man, and Tressel's a 55-year-old guy, or however old he was. So it's not really fair to compare him. But here's a quote from Clarette's high school coach from the an Ohio newspaper called The Plains Dealer, and it says this. Tom McDaniel said, Maurice Clarette is a victim of circumstances that he created for himself. And the Plains Dealer goes on to say, this quote certainly wouldn't advance the redemptive narrative being proffered by the filmmakers. What his high school coach seems to be saying is that, you know, Clarette has caused all these circumstances to happen to himself. I mean, he was the one who was making some very threatening statements before the national championship game to the media. He was the one who tried to overturn the NCAA rule or the NFL rule and the NCAA rule about not being able to go to the pros. Yes, but he was a kid. Tressel, like you said, seems to be the one who was the adult in the situation that should have stood by Clarette. And at the end, he says, well, what else is he doing right now? He might as well be nice to Clarette and make amends.
Yeah, there is a general understanding when you have collegiate athletes that an understanding between coaches and athletes and the sports information director that everything needs to go be double-checked before you agree to do an interview. So I would contend that Ohio State let Maurice Clarette down by turning him loose to ESPN's Gene Wojciechowski before they had gone over, you know, maybe they did go over it. So I want to leave that option as a possibility. But to me, if I'm the SID or the AD, and certainly Jim Tressel, I've got a freshman, there'd never been a true freshman start at running back at Ohio State. And so that was, you know, he was already becoming a superstar. But man, if I've got... And it's not like Gene Wojciechowski is out to get Maurice Clarette. He's a reporter doing a story.
Yeah.
And so if I'm the AD, SID, and coach of Maurice Clarette, I want to sit down with him before he talks to Gene Wojciechowski and say, now you need to know something. Whatever you say here has a chance to blow up into something massive. Mm-hmm. So be very careful what you say. In fact, I would contend, and this happens a lot, I don't think you let Maurice Clarette sit with Gene Wojciechowski without Jim Tressel and without the SID present.
That's normal? There's usually someone babysitting him?
It happens frequently. You're talking about, again, you're talking protecting the athlete. You don't want an 18-year-old to say something that's going to get him or the school in trouble, or her.
Yeah.
And so... that's not uncommon for the SID to sit there with the reporter or the coach to sit there with the reporter. And let's hang on just a second, Maurice. You need to be careful what you're saying here, because this is where people are going to go with it. You may not know this. This is how people are going to hear what you're saying about this. So I would contend they let Clarette down there. I would contend they let him down by not making it possible for him to go to the funeral.
Yeah.
Now, he's 18. He's getting a lot of accolades, a lot of publicity. And so I would agree to a point with his high school coach in saying that, yeah, he is saying these things. He's putting himself out there. And if you're going to get the accolades, you got to be ready for the criticism. But again, that's part of what Jim Tressel promised Clarette's mom. Mm-hmm. I will take care of him. I will make sure he's in a good position. That's not just on the football field. That's off the field as well, in my opinion.
Well, he definitely needed it. And if you think about any 18-year-old, I was a baby preacher. I was preaching at that age, and I could have used a grown-up preacher sitting next to me and go, Luke, before you say this, hold on. Let's clarify exactly what you should be saying. I think any kid in that situation is overwhelmed by the media. Now, the other thing going on in the story is that he's from Ohio. There's a gentleman from Akron, Ohio, named LeBron James, who's coming up the same time as he is.
I've heard of him.
And he plays basketball. I don't know if you're familiar with that sport, but that's the one-and-done comparisons that he sees LeBron signing a $100 million contract with Nike.
Never went to college.
Yeah, never goes to college. Clarette's sitting in there going, I can't even fly back for a funeral. I don't have the money to do that. And LeBron James is making $100 million from Nike.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so that was the genesis of the Wojciechowski questioning about the one-and-done, probably. Don't you think?
It was, yeah. And I think it's a very fair question. And this is all part of what I was saying earlier about the NCAA's the fact that they're on the petri dish right now and everyone's examining everything that the NCAA does. There are a lot of very prominent and respected mm-hmm. people in the sports world who believe that the NCAA is essentially a monopoly, a cartel, if you will. The NCAA is not they're restricting some basic rights that human beings have in the workplace. Mm-hmm. Johnny Manziel, for example, got in trouble or investigated for signing autographs and making some money off of that. And that's an NCAA violation. So the NCAA mandates you have to be 3 years out of high school before you can enter the NFL draft. And a lot of people are questioning. And Maurice Clarette was one of them. Mm-hmm. Hey, if I'm good enough to be drafted, by an NFL team, why are you preventing me from doing that? Why are you mandating, what right do you have to do that? Now, employers have, the right to do a lot of things when it comes to, the people they hire.
Yeah.
And so the NFL, is going to stand by that. We're also going to, we're going to say that you can't take drugs if you're going to play in the NFL. You could look at that as an infringement on freedom. Well, sorry, that's one of our rules. But in general, I think most of us feel like that people ought to have the freedom to work where they want to work. Where it gets really tricky is, when you get into sports, things have been done a certain way a long time. And you're trying to overturn something that's been very, very profitable for both the NFL and the NCAA. You know the NCAA doesn't want this rule to go away because Maurice Clarette and who knows how many others would immediately jump to the NFL. If not from high school, then maybe after 1 year of college. We see it in basketball already, college basketball. A lot of kids don't even go to college, but you had that stretch where they didn't, Kevin Garnett and others, even back to Moses Malone. Now you go for a year, you play at Kentucky, you play at Carolina, you play anywhere, and then you bolt for the NBA. So it's a very ticklish situation, and you've got a lot of people with billions of dollars at stake who are arguing about it.
And the NFL benefits because they have ready-made players that can jump right in. And there are already known characters and commodities. So you know the first-round draft pick for the Cowboys because you saw him play – well, maybe not this last year because who watches the center from Wisconsin? But for the most part, you have a superstar who can come in, rejuvenate a franchise that might not have that much enthusiasm from the fan base. Whereas in the NBA, you don't know these kids. Most of us who are just fringe basketball fans have no clue who these kids are coming to the NBA. And so the NFL doesn't want to change that rule. They've got a good deal right now.
Yeah, Major League Baseball has a farm system. You have, the Texas Rangers have, you know, a handful, I think five or six minor league teams, and they move their players up all the way to AAA before they come to the major league team. That's an official farm system. College football and college basketball are unofficial farm systems for the NFL. Now, obviously, there are a ton of kids who, in all sports, men and women, young men and young women, who play collegiate athletics. They know they're not going to go pro in those sports. It's a way for them to afford college, and we don't really hear much about them. But college football is, while it is great on its own, it is a de facto farm system for the NFL. That is a reality. I don't think anyone, you might have some people who wouldn't be comfortable with that wording, but I don't think anyone would deny that that's what that is. Look, you want, you see kids in high school and you say, that kid's got some talent. And then you say, now I get a chance to watch him in college and see how he matures on the football field as a football player. Now I'm going to draft him. Okay, and even then, you draft somebody, and sometimes it doesn't work out. But they've had that second level, that college level, for them to be able to try to make it happen, to try to become a better player. It's another level for the NFL to see them compete on. And that's why you primarily see players from FBS, which is the highest level of Division I college football, get drafted. You see, like, Abilene Christian, you know, our alma mater.
Yep.
We've got several guys in the NFL. They came from Division II, but you've got to be a freak at Division II to make it, or Division III to make it into the NFL, because you're not playing against the same level of competition that Alabama plays in the SEC, for example.
Yeah.
So it's just another level for NFL scouts to see these players.
Yeah. Well, you speak about Daniel Manning was a second-round draft pick for the Bears out of ACU.
Yep.
And when he was there, it was like when you make a video game character and you make them all 100 on everything,
right,
and everyone else is like normal. That's what Manning was like at ACU.
Yeah, yeah. He was. He played a little bit of wide receiver. He would play defensive back. He was a kick returner, punt returner. He scored just about every way you could score, catching passes, you know, running them back, kicks and punts. You know, and you mentioned the video game. That's we touched on that earlier. But the NCAA made hundreds of millions, maybe billions of dollars off their relationship with video game manufacturers. They would take a Tim Tebow and take his name off. But when you picked Florida as your team, you had a left-handed quarterback who wore number 15 and looked exactly like Tim Tebow.
Yep.
They just would take the name off. They would take the name off, thinking that would protect them legally from having to pay Tim Tebow anything. Well, a guy named Ed O'Bannon, who and his
UCLA
brother
Charles,
he and his brother Charles played for UCLA, went on to play in the NBA. They got together with some other plaintiffs. They filed a lawsuit, and I'm telling you, the NCAA is my prediction: the NCAA is going to lose that badly. And that will open the floodgates for even more lawsuits about how the NCAA essentially has made unbelievable amounts of money off these young people. And yes, Ed O'Bannon and these other people are getting their college education paid for sure. But it is wildly, grossly disproportionate and I would argue unethical for the NCAA to make that kind of money off of these players' likenesses, and not pass that on to the player. The jig is about up, in my opinion. I think you're going to see that case settled in 2014, and it's not going to go well for the NCAA.
Really, that's interesting.
You heard it here first on the Newsworthy with Norsworthy podcast.
Hey, that's what we're talking about. That is very newsworthy. Hey, let's go back to Claret. Why in the world did he never get a second shot in the NFL? I mean, there are plenty of guys who went to jail and they got a second shot. Plexico Burress shot himself, and then he got another shot getting back in the NFL. Vic was in prison. A lot of guys had some trouble background and get in the NFL. Why is Claret not in the league? You think about the guys the Cowboys have at running back who are undrafted free agents. None of them have anything like Claret, who goes for 18 touchdowns, 5.5 yards a carry at Ohio State during his 1 year of college football. How is he not getting another shot?
Well, I mean, you have to look at it. He's, you know, now he's in his 30s. And when he got out of prison a few years ago, you know, he was not in football shape. And I don't even know how interested he was in trying to come back.
He wanted to come back. His line was, I didn't quit football. Football quit me.
Yeah. Yeah. And he, you know, there was, if I remember right, I want to say, and of course it would have to be the Raiders, but I have a recollection that that he looked at, you know, an opportunity to try to come back. I just think the ship had sailed so far. I mean, by the time he even got to the Broncos, you know, he was 2 years.
Yeah,
and you know, you could argue, hey, he's got fresh legs. He hasn't been beaten up for the last 10 years, but his skills had eroded at that point, and I don't know exactly why. I don't know how. I know what he said, that quote you just quoted, but I just don't know how. I'll put it this way. Let's just make sure we state this, state the obvious. If a guy can play in the NFL, the NFL's going to let him play. Listen, they don't care hardly what you – I mean, look at, as you pointed out, some of the guys who've come back to play. If you can play football, if you can score touchdowns, the NFL will find a way to get you back onto the field. Ben Roethlisberger had a very, you know, seedy off-the-field incident. If you can play, they'll find a way. So, you know, Claret, I know what he said, but I have a hard time believing that if he really was capable of producing on the field, that someone wouldn't give him a shot. There are some bad football teams.
Don't you think that was part of the reason the filmmakers showed him training? He's trying to say, hey, look at me. I'm in good shape. I'm working hard. I can still do this. Isn't that what they were trying to communicate?
Maybe. I don't know.
Yeah, he said he actually had a little phase in which he was trying to make the Olympic rugby team. That was this summer. I think Sports Illustrated did a story about him then. So he seems like he's trying to do something. But regardless, the documentary was well-received, partly because everyone loves a good redemption story. And that seemed like one. He's turned his life around. He had this great quote about what he wanted people to know from the film. He says, I hope people can identify with these moments in my life. I had the world in my hands, but I threw it all away. But through the spirit of never giving up, through starting over and forgiving yourself for what you've done, you can repair yourself. Great, great quote. Seems like the guy's turned his life around. It's a really encouraging story. I almost fear, though, that in our love for athletes and athletics, we idolize people. And part of the process of when we idolize people is we idealize them. We make them better than they really are. And part of, I think, the business of what you do is you're telling stories about these athletes because these are our heroes. And sometimes I feel like we airbrush who they are. And so we tell like one-sided stories like, hey, this is a guy who had wrong done to him, and then he redeemed himself by, you know, working hard and getting his life turned around. And in the process, we kind of missed the rest of who he really is. Like he made mistakes. He was part of the process. He created some of his own circumstances, even if the NCAA was wrong, even if Tressel didn't get his back. But the beautiful thing is that he turned his life around. I mean, that's a really encouraging story.
It is, and I think what you say is true. It's not just in sports. It's with a lot of stories. You know, it's holiday time now. We're about to be with our families for a long time. And, you know, I've seen this in my own family. We like stories. And you know, we like fairy tales.
Yeah.
And the reality is there really is no such thing as happily ever after, really. Things just are more nuanced than a Disney, you know, movie can present or a fairy tale can give us. We like, you know, we want to say Maurice Claret, he's a thug, end of story, you know, and then you look at it and you say a little deeper, wait a second, did someone hang him out to dry?
Yeah.
which doesn't, by the way, as you say, absolve him of any guilt, because there is personal responsibility. It's just that things usually aren't as cut and dried. And you think about that with your families. Why do we have issues with our families? Well, it's often not because of something that happened that is clear cut. It's words that were said and ways they were interpreted, and then they calcify over time. And all of a sudden you look up, it's been 4 or 5 years and you've drifted from these people you're supposedly bound to forever by blood. And I think we like the idea of stories having nice, neat endings, because we realize most of the things in our lives don't have nice, neat endings. Yeah. I did a story, Luke, on Clyde Gates, who's a wide receiver for the New York Jets. He went to ACU. He's an amazing story. He's a guy who never played high school football. Mm-hmm. He wanted to play basketball, and he was a good basketball player, but he played a couple of years in junior college. It didn't really work out for him. And by the summer of 2007, his cousin Bernard Scott was coming to ACU. His other cousin, another relative, Aston Whiteside, was coming to college at ACU. And so he decided to show up at ACU. He wasn't even enrolled, but just decided to enroll because he thought, maybe I'll go out for football, because Bernard kept saying, hey, you know, we used to play growing up, let's play. Well, he becomes an All-America wide receiver. Well, his dad had been in prison since the time that Clyde was 6 years old. His dad was a drug dealer and a guy had been convicted of first-degree murder. Well, Clyde's senior season, in October of his senior year, I went with Clyde as he got his dad out of jail after, you know, whatever it was, 17, 18 years.
Wow.
He hadn't even seen him since he was 9 years old. And I wrote a story on it for ACU Today magazine. And it was this great story about a father and a son. And I talked about how the father was the prodigal, you know, and it was the son who forgave him. Well, that's a great story. This father, the son reunited, the son gets drafted, goes to the NFL. Well, the reality now is a few years later, the father and son, you know, they're struggling because the dad has found it difficult to get back into the real world, as Maurice Claret did coming out of prison. And so that nice, neat story from 2011 isn't so nice and neat anymore. And I think it happens not just in sports, but in real life as well.
Wow. Yeah, that's definitely true. Life is far more complicated than the stories that we see on the silver screen.
And by the way, Luke, the things we really haven't talked about yet that is kind of undergirding this entire story is the whole black-white issue. You've got, you know, a white coach in Jim Tressel. You've got the young black, you know, athlete. You have that kind of plantation mentality, the older white man, the younger black man. Mm-hmm. He's supposed to take care of him. He doesn't take care of him as much as he needs to. You know, and when you get into issues of black and white race, very little is black and white figuratively. It gets very complicated, and you start looking at issues of profiling, and that's a big part of this story as well. And you've got Ohio State. Would they have stood by Craig Krenzel, the white quarterback, had something like that happened? You know, in every way, every step along the way. Was Maurice Claret an easy target to kick to the curb because he was, you know, a poor, you know, black kid from the mean streets of Youngstown? Those are fair questions, and my hunch is to some degree that did happen.
Yeah. Well, if you look at the people in the stands in Columbus for most of his games, it's a pretty white audience, and there is some interesting dynamic there. You're definitely right. And obviously Geiger and Tressel are both white guys. Most of the boosters are around him are older white guys. Very interesting dynamic, definitely.
And then you get Jim Brown, the great Hall of Fame NFL running back who comes into the scene. He's very much of a civil rights and anti-discrimination activist. And he comes in, you know, basically calling out Ohio State. Mm-hmm. And Jim Brown is at the point in his life, you know, in his 70s now, where he pulls no punches. If he sees what he thinks is discrimination, he's going to call it out. And so, you know, there's Maurice Clarett looking for someone to come alongside. And it took, you know, Jim Brown to stand by him. Again, not this is where it gets very awkward. You've got a lot of people who did things wrong, but you know, you go back to Tressel suggesting that the Clarett call the car dealer to go get the car. You've got a lot of people to blame, a lot of people at fault, including Clarett. And you just say, what kind of it makes you look more with a wide lens, with a wider lens to say, how about this system in general? Is this system working? Is it, you know, are we preying upon young black men to make white guys rich and famous?
Yeah, that is definitely a lot deeper of a story than you want to turn this out to be. That's good stuff, man. Well, hey, we don't have any more time, but Grant, thank you so much for joining the show. Hope you had a good time with us, and we'll have to have you back again soon, all right?
Sounds good, Luke. Take care. Happy holidays.
Thanks for checking out Newsworthy with Norsworthy. Make sure to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. You are now adjourned.